My name's Ed Howard. I'm with the Alliance for Health Reform. And on behalf of Senator Rockefeller and Senator Collins and our board of directors, I want to welcome you to this briefing on focusing on ways to use Medicare as a model to move toward health coverage for all Americans. Our partner in today's program is the Commonwealth Fund. As most of you know, it is a century-old philanthropy based in New York City that supports work on a whole range of health policy issues with an emphasis on vulnerable populations. We're very pleased to have the president of the fund, Karen Davis, with us to introduce the topic and help moderate. Now, we know that both Senator Obama and Senator McCain have proposed ways to broaden health care coverage in the United States, though certainly Mr. Obama has a more ambitious plan than Mr. McCain does. There may be differing views on whether we ought to strive for universal coverage, though there are many Republicans and Democrats who do endorse that goal. The trick is, how do you do it? Commonwealth Fund has actually given us our starting point for today's discussion of that issue. It's a set of building blocks, if you will, that the authors propose aimed at reaching nearly universal coverage with relatively little disruption in current coverage patterns or and with relatively low government costs, using Medicare as a main platform on which to build those expansions. Now, before I introduce my co-moderator and we move to the panel, I just want to clarify a few logistical notes. By Monday, you'll be able to view a webcast of this briefing on kaisernetwork.org. You can also view a transcript within a few days, and there are copies of materials that you have in your packets on both the kaisernetwork.org website and the Alliance website, allhealth.org. We'll let you know when the transcript's available. There's a podcast you can download. You can wallow in this discussion for the next week and get every little bit of analysis. We're going to ask you to fill out the green question cards at the appropriate time. There is a microphone here, and my eyes can't see it, but I know there are microphones back there that you can use to stand and deliver your question orally at the appropriate time. So let's get started. Please take a moment to turn your cell phones off so that you won't be distracted and we won't be distracted. excuse me, I'm pleased to have representing, as I mentioned, representing the Commonwealth Fund today, the CEO of the fund, Karen Davis, who's one of America's leading health economists. She's co-author of the paper and proposal that's the jumping off point for today's discussion. And Karen, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Ed. It's a real pleasure to partner with the Alliance for Health Reform on a number of activities, and particularly to co-host today's session and to have an opportunity to share with you some recent work that was published in Health Affairs called Building Blocks of Universal Coverage and Health System Savings was an accompanying issue brief to that report that I know you have in your packets. As Ed mentioned, we were established in 1918 to support independent research on healthcare and to, in particular, to promote the common weal, the common good. So that's where the Commonwealth comes from. And today our mission is very much focused on moving the U.S. toward a high-performance health system that simultaneously achieves better access, improved quality, and greater efficiency. There's been a saying for a long time that you can have two of those three, but you can't have all three of access, quality, and improved efficiency. But, in fact, our board of directors in 2005 set up a commission on a high-performance health system, and that is their charge, to come up with ideas that can simultaneously address all three of those issues. It's chaired by Dr. James Mongan, who is president and CEO of the Partners Healthcare System in Boston and has distinguished experts and leaders from across the country. As the commission has focused on the U.S. healthcare system, it thought the best place to start was just taking stock. And it has issued national and state scorecards on health system performance that score the U.S. or state health systems not against what's ideal, but what has been achieved somewhere for some group of patients. For the most part, that's comparisons within the U.S., so it's looking for what do the top 10% of hospitals do, what do the 10% of health plans do, what do the best five states do, and how much could we gain if all of the U.S. were to reach the levels, benchmark levels of performance of high-performing organizations or geographic areas within the U.S. The Commission has since turned to really trying to find strategies that would get us to high performance. One key strategy is improving health insurance coverage. It issued a report called A Roadmap to Health Insurance for All, Principles for Reform. It has set out an overall ambitious agenda for the next president that says it's not enough just to do coverage. One must simultaneously address issues of quality and efficiency in the healthcare system. And to help with that effort, the Commonwealth Fund released a report called Bending the Curve in December of 2007 that features 15 different reform options and has estimates from the Lewin Group of how each of those 15 proposals would affect total health spending over 10 years and how it would affect each of the major sectors, the federal budget, state and local government, employers, and households. So it hopes to move this debate forward. It's not recommending or endorsing any of those particular options, but getting them out on the table with some real numbers so that there can be greater focus and discussion of those alternatives. Certainly, I think the conclusion of the Commission is that we have lots of opportunity for improvement in the healthcare system. We all know that we're spending 16% of the gross domestic product on healthcare. The Medicare program projects that we will go to 20% of GDP in the next 10 years if we don't alter our current course. We've also seen in our international work that the U.S. is falling further behind other countries on issues like preventable mortality amenable to Medicare. When we did our scorecard, the U.S. was 15th out of 19 countries on that indicator of performance. More recent data published in Health Affairs in January of this year shows that while we've improved by 4%, other countries have improved by 16%, and we're now 19th out of 19 countries. So it's important to really get ideas, constructive ideas, out on the table, get some discussion, and really look at how we can improve performance across all three of these issues of coverage, quality, and efficiency. And, in fact, that is what the work we're here today to discuss tries to do. Modeling that was done for building blocks looks at combining coverage for all with other broad reforms to see what its implications are for the total health system. And it also lays a foundation for building coverage, building toward universal coverage for all Americans by preserving the role of the private market, but doing so in a way that builds on the strengths of current public programs as well as improving the quality of care. I think what unites us all in this room and in this city and in this nation is a desire to get the best health care for our families and our friends, and to do so in a way that gets high value out of the resources that we invest in healthcare. Certainly a majority of the public agrees with that. I think our presidential candidates agree with that. And we really have a historic opportunity with a new administration in 2009 to make changes to transform our healthcare system and really assure our health and prosperity as a nation going forward. Thank you. And with that, I might take the opportunity, yes, if I might, of introducing my colleague, and I'll leave it to Ed for the rest of the panel, but introduce my colleague, Kathy Shane, who is Senior Vice President for Research and Evaluation at the Commonwealth Fund. I've mentioned all of this work that we do. That's the royal we. It is often done by Kathy Shane and people in the audience like Stu Gutterman and Tony Shee and Sarah Collins and other professional staff at the Commonwealth Fund. But Kathy has been the lead author on our national scorecard, our state scorecard reports, and is a major resource to the Commission, and is here today to, as lead author on the Health Affairs article, to present this work to you.
Thank you, Karen. As both Karen and Ed mentioned, you have in your packets the article, and when you came in, and I don't know how Alliance staff did it, but they matched it to the color of my shirt, a bright pink issue brief, and my remarks are going to be summarizing both of those. What we have laid out in the Health Affairs article and then expanded on in the issue brief is potential building blocks and a framework for expanding insurance to all that would offer a new national connector that for the first time would have a reformed Medicare-sponsored public plan along with private plans, and it would offer it to the under 65 population. And I'll describe that framework and the estimates that the Lewin Group did on what its potential was in terms of coverage. We've also looked at what would happen if we had a more integrated health insurance system that had expanded to everyone in the country for a new foundation for insurance, and if we coupled it with strategic system reforms, information systems, payment reform, and population health to achieve the triple goal that Karen just discussed of access, quality, and efficiency, slowing the growth of health expenditures, but with an emphasis on value. In the building blocks approach, we set up a new national connector, and the next slide I'll go through the elements of this, that builds on the strengths of private and group coverage, integrates them, and offers new options for the small group and individual market. It would achieve near universal coverage, covering all but 1% of the population. It would do it by offering new product, a new public-sponsored plan, as well as private insurance plans, much the way Medicare now offers a Medicare Advantage product to those in the over 65 population. And the estimates are the efficiencies in terms of administrative savings as well as building on Medicare's national networks is that it would be able to offer products that are at least 30% cheaper than are currently available, particularly in the small group and individual market. There would be new choices that would offer improved coverage for the insured, not, as well as covering the uninsured, both lower premiums and more comprehensive benefit packages. It offers a framework of moving from where we are now to universal with minimum disruption in where people are. If you like the insurance that you now have, it's working well, there's no need to move. All decisions to move would be voluntary. The plan, as the estimates of the first year impact from Lewin illustrate, could be done at minimal net national cost with administrative savings offsetting some of the costs of increased use for the uninsured population. And if you couple this insurance approach, this new, more integrated foundation, with payment reform, with information systems such as HIT and a Center for Comparative Effectiveness, with population health initiatives, there's an opportunity to have a system approach that achieves savings for the nation and offsets the federal costs of that insurance expansion. The core elements of the building blocks framework for insurance start and are organized around a new national insurance connector. This connector would offer a reformed Medicare-like option, which we've called Medicare Extra, and I want to underscore that this is an integrated plan. You would not need to supplement benefits, so it's offering a package that looks much like what large employers currently offer now. It has drugs, it has co-payments, but it covers preventive care services in full, and it provides a catastrophic cap. But that plan would use Medicare's broad network of hospitals and doctors and be available nationally. It would build off Medicare's payment systems with reforms that I'll discuss. We call this Medicare Extra, and I'll refer to it later throughout as Medicare Extra. It would be coupled with insurance market reform, both inside the connector if you came in and took the public option or an array of private options. There would be no questions about what your health status would be. It would be adjusted community rated with guaranteed issue, an external connector to the connector, those same rules would run in the regions where it was operating. We've coupled that with tax credits that would assure that coverage was affordable. Low-income families, those in the bottom two tax brackets, would not have to pay any more than 5% of their incomes for premiums, and higher income no more than 10%. So there's a tax credit for premium subsidies. We've also expanded the Medicaid program to at least 150% of poverty for adults and childless adults. States could, at their option, go higher. And within Medicaid, we've asked Lewin to model Medicaid's prices coming up to Medicare to avoid the disadvantage Medicare recipients now face in markets. We require everyone to have insurance within that framework, so there would be an individual mandate accompanied with these tax credits for affordability and expanded options, and employers would either need to provide coverage or pay into an insurance fund as part of the support for the expansion. Within Medicare itself, we've eliminated the two-year waiting period for the disabled, allow early buy-in. Employers and individuals could buy into Medicare early at an actuarial premium for those aged 60 or older. And we also would offer the Medicare Extra benefit package as a supplemental package to the Medicare beneficiaries. So they could, for the first time, if they wanted to, have one integrated package rather than having to carry three insurance cards if they now want to sup Medicare and drugs. This illustrates what the estimates are that would happen if one set up this type of framework, these building blocks. Almost everyone would get covered. We'd be covering 44 million out of the estimated 48 million uninsured. You'd be automatically enrolled through the tax system, so the people we miss would be mainly the non-tax filers. The flows of the uninsured would both be going into private coverage. Some employers would be offering for the first time. Some would go into Medicaid, and many would go into the new connector, which would be open to anyone in the individual market as well as the small group market, employers under 100. As you can see from the arrows, there's also a movement from the currently insured. We estimate as many as 50 million, 49 million would move to new sources of coverage, including into this new national connector, which would pick up about 60 million people, two-thirds of which would be in the new publicly sponsored Medicare Extra option, but the others would be in private group plans. So this is a new competitive dynamic that would be set up both inside the connector and external, that you would have a choice of staying and purchasing directly through private markets, as many employers do now, or if you were a small employer individual coming into the new connector. Similar to what Massachusetts has done in the connector concept, only this would be run nationally and it could be run through regional operations. What that ends up doing in terms of the distribution of coverage, we leave most of the employer sponsor base intact, although some employers would now be purchasing through the connector. The new connector picks up a large share of the uninsured as well as the individual and small group market, and Medicaid stays about the same. Some Medicaid beneficiaries end up moving into the connector, moving into their employer coverage. And remember, those circles are all choices, so there's the ability to move voluntarily through those different sources of coverage and sponsorship. Turning to what could happen if we take that approach, and that approach alone could be done with minimal national costs. The estimates are only $15 billion in national costs off a $2 trillion base. With coverage alone, there would be federal costs. If you coupled it with payment reform, starting to pay for medical homes, better enhanced primary care, more bundled episodes of care payments, and reforms that spread across the Medicare population, both current and through the connector. If you coupled it with those proposals, plus HIT, we could get a fully implemented HIT system, health information technology, and a new center for information about comparative effectiveness and public health initiatives. We estimate, if you look out 10 years, that there would be net national savings that would accumulate over time, building by the 10th year, of at least $1.6 trillion. And this, as you can see, in each year is a small accumulation, but starting from a $2 trillion base, which is expected to go to $4 trillion, these savings add up quickly. The savings for the federal government would offset the cost of coverage expansions. So the initial expansions, if they were done just alone in coverage, would not be self-financed, but savings could self-finance them. We would bend the cost curve compared to where it currently is substantially with better access, better quality, and efficiency. And to sum up, this approach is trying to take a systems approach that starts with the basic goal of achieving coverage for everyone, but in an integrated way. So there's a more secure insurance foundation with the leverage for payment reforms and other reforms, the potential for a new competitive dynamic. If we take a systems approach, we can get coverage with value. But I want to end with just one statement that this requires political will. It wouldn't be easy to do it. The sooner we act, the better, both for families, businesses, and public sector, but it takes new systems put in place, a new way of thinking about insurance, and a more integrated approach. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Kathy. That's a very sound foundation for the rest of the discussion today. We don't often have on Alliance programs members of Congress gracing our podium, so we're particularly pleased to have Congressman Tom Price of Georgia with us here today. He's been among the most active members of Congress on health issues. He's, for example, the main co-sponsor in the House of bipartisan legislation that would give states the chance to pursue a whole range of reforms to broaden coverage and contain costs. He also happens to be an orthopedic surgeon and has some firsthand experience with the Medicare program in that regard. His opinion piece from The Hill on today's topic is in your packets, and we're delighted to have him on the panel today. Congressman Price.
Thank you, Ed, very much. And after my presentation, you may see why they don't normally have members of Congress on the panel. We'll see. I want to sincerely thank the Commonwealth and the Alliance for hosting this and for allowing me to join you today. And I guess the first question would be, why am I here? Ed pretty much summarized it. I've spent 20-plus years in the practice of medicine and have appreciated, I think, firsthand the consequences of the decisions that are made in these halls and the buildings around us here in Washington as how it relates to on the ground, in the clinic room, in the operating room, and what those consequences are. So I have a passion. I share a passion with my friends here on the panel for health system reform, fundamental health system reform, and I'm excited as well by the prospects of the presidential election and the true contrast in choices that I think that we will have. I title my vision for health care, patient-centered health care. I think oftentimes when we talk about health care, we lose sight of the fact that what we're talking about is patients. And when you think about that, we're talking about you. We're talking about you, we're talking about me. Every individual who has who exists in our nation has at some point had some health challenge. And sometimes they're major and sometimes they're minor, but it's a very personal system. It's a very personal question that we're asking when we talk about healthcare. So I entitle my vision patient-centered healthcare, and I believe we're at a crossroads for a variety of reasons, some of which have been outlined, but demographics and cost and the like. What are we looking for in patient-centered healthcare? This is no different than what any of us up here would describe, or anybody who has any vision or passion about healthcare. We're interested in a system that's affordable. We're interested in a system that's accessible by individuals. We're interested in one that's responsive. One might ask, who should the system be responsive to? I would suggest it needs to be responsive to patients, not necessarily those that are devising the system. It needs to be innovative. We need to make certain that we continue to have the greatest healthcare in the world, and it needs to be of the highest quality. What is Medicare? I would suggest to you that it's none of those things, that Medicare is none of those things. And consequently, the question being asked, should Medicare be the model for reform? Obviously, my recommendation to you is that it not be the model for reform, and we'll go through some of the reasons why. Medicare is not affordable. It's clearly not affordable either from a standpoint of cost, or I would suggest it's not affordable from a standpoint of options that patients have. It's not accessible. 25% of physicians across this nation now limit the number of Medicare patients that they see. The Mayo Clinic is now limiting the number of Medicare patients that it sees, the Mayo Clinic. If that's happening, you know that the system is about to implode on its own weight. It's not responsive. It took us 40 years to get Medicare to see that they needed to have a prescription drug program within its confines. So it obviously is not responsive to patients. It's not innovative, not on the cutting edge in anything, and it isn't because of its structure. It only pays for things that it says it will pay for. You can't pay for innovation if you don't have a code that responds for innovation. And it's not of the highest quality, and I would suggest it isn't because it is not all of the things above. So is Medicare the model for reform? I would hope not. I think we are brighter and better than the system that we currently have. I would also suggest to you that the current system that we have has used Medicare as a model. You know that private insurance right now essentially tracks Medicare for reimbursement and for coding and all those kinds of things, and consequently Medicare is essentially the model that we have for the system that we currently have. So we're at a crossroads. Are we going to go more in the direction of individuals in this city and buildings around here deciding where health care goes, or are we going to let doctors and patients determine the direction for health care? When I was in the operating room, I never asked this question or made this statement, but I probably should have, given the consequences of what has occurred. Now, what about Medicare? What is a fundamental reason why it ought not be trusted? Well, it isn't trustworthy, and it's not reliable. And it's not because the people in the system are bad. It's not because Ms. Walensky and others in CMS previously and now are bad. It's that they have a different mission. Their mission is to make the bottom line meet. It's not to be responsive to patients. And so when your mission is the bottom line, then that's what happens. That's what you pay attention to. It's not reliable. I would suggest this comes from the original bill that authorized Medicare. Nothing in this title shall be construed to authorize any federal officer or employee to exercise any supervision or control over the practice of medicine or the manner in which medical services are provided. That's still on the books today. That's still the law of the land. I would suggest to you that anybody who has an appreciation for health care understands that that has been violated multiple times. I see my clock isn't working, Ed, and I appreciate that. I'm moving on through.
Your 8 minutes is eternal.
What about the sources of health care spending? You see a significant change over the last 45 years. You see there the consumer payments in 1960 were about 50%. In 2005, government funds were about 50%. You all know the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. Historical gap between the estimates for costs for health care in this nation and what they actually are. In 1965, it was estimated that in 1990, Medicare would cost $9 billion. In inflation-adjusted dollars, in 1990, it actually cost $67 billion. Medicare spending today is $450 billion. Now, it's important to point out that 9 and 67 were for Part A and that 450 is the whole shebang. But you can appreciate that the estimates for what Medicare costs have been less than accurate. Rising costs of health care. This goes back to 1960. It's the per capita cost, and it goes from about $1,000 all the way up to $6,000, a little more than $6,000. Costs continue to increase without a doubt. So how do we solve this problem? I would suggest that there are two pillars upon which we need to build a positive patient-centered reform. One is universal coverage, and you won't, I don't know that you'll find a whole lot of conservatives who will stand up and say that you absolutely must have universal coverage, but we've got to have universal coverage. You can't have a system where there are 45, 46, 47 million people episodically uninsured at some point during the year and have the system work. And I think that the second pillar is a defined contribution mechanism. Universal coverage, how do you get there if you're not going to have an individual mandate or an employer mandate or a pay-or-play? Tax credits, we use the tax system to incentivize and make it so that every individual in this nation, it would be financially wise for them to gain health insurance and financially foolish for them not to have it. And you can do that through a variety of mechanisms, deductions, credits, refundable tax credits, advanceable refundable tax credits, tax equity for the purchase of insurance, various pooling mechanisms that exist now and other more dynamic mechanisms. And then the second pillar, defined contribution. What does that mean? It means that patients own and control their health insurance. They own and control their health insurance. So when they call up the insurance company or the federal government, the individual on the other end of the line says, how may I help you, instead of, why don't you call somebody who cares? Because right now, patients don't have power. They don't have any power in the system. How do you get the system to move in the direction that we want it to move? Hopefully, we all want it to move in the direction that patients want it to move. The only way to do that is to empower patients. I would suggest to you that the only way that you empower patients is to allow them to have control over their health insurance policy and make it financially feasible and advisable that every patient, every individual in this nation have health insurance. I'm privileged to be on the panel. I look forward to your questions and look forward to the discussion of the others. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Price. Excuse me. By the way, we didn't get these slides in time to put them in your packets, but we will make them available on our website shortly after the briefing. Next, we're going to hear from Steve Lieberman, whose mastery of healthcare numbers is legend in this town. He's been head of the health staff at CBO. He's been a senior staff member at OMB. He played a key role at CMS in implementing the new drug benefit in 2004, and he's now a consultant to a number of groups on a range of healthcare policy topics, mostly quantitative in nature, but not exclusively. And we're very pleased to have your skills brought to this panel. Steve?
Thank you very much, Ed. If anyone has difficulty hearing me in the back, let me know, please. It's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank Ed and the Alliance for organizing this session, and I particularly want to acknowledge the contribution of Kathy, Karen, and their colleagues at Commonwealth, not just for the article, the Building Blocks article, which I think is extremely impressive and an important piece, but for their work over the last several, many years, but the last several years in particular on this topic. Unfortunately, my role today is not to focus on how full the glass is, but rather on the parts of the glass that are still empty. But I do want to explicitly acknowledge, I think, the importance of their contribution and the difficulty of trying to move in what I think is a very intelligent way, which is to deal with incremental reform, but to try to keep all of the pieces that are part of our complex health system in mind and try to address them. I will quickly go through three main topics. I will try to first give a high-level assessment of the building block proposal. I'll then second try to focus on the fiscal pressures that we face, and particularly those associated with excess growth in healthcare costs, as Representative Price has described. And I then want to focus on some of the key choices that I think we will frame as we think about the policy debate. Okay, thank you. Is this better from the background? So I'm not going to go over what I list in these slides, some of the key open issues, but I do want to just highlight a couple of them. I worry over time about whether costs and revenues are balanced. I worry about whether we have adequate mechanisms for controlling the rate of increase in costs, and I also worry about how we would have private plans that are at risk operate side by side with governmental plans that are not at risk, and particularly whether we set up some significant selection issues. The second thing I'd like to make a comment on in terms of the building block proposal is, again, I want to compliment Kathy and Karen and their colleagues for including a cost estimate, but I want to observe from, I think, if I can put on a CBO perspective, that it's simply not credible from a CBO perspective at this point. There may be further details. John Shields and the Lewin folks are experienced estimators. But at this point, based on what I've seen, I just want to highlight a couple of things. First, there are savings that are assumed from, I believe, unproven approaches and to some extent unspecified approaches. Second, I think the Medicare expansion, as I understand it, looks to be quite costly, and I'm not sure I see adequate offsets for those costs. Third, I worry about the longer-range imbalance. If costs are essentially the cost of the program and the subsidies are harnessed to the increasing cost of health care, and we haven't been able to succeed in bending that cost curve down, that has, I think, pretty dire fiscal implications. And finally, I worry about whether the tax rate is adequate. The next two slides, this one comes from recent data released from CBO in an issue brief, and the next slide, which is in your packet, is actually a slide I just literally lifted from CBO. The green line here represents Medicare and Medicaid spending, as a share of the economy, it will more than double over the next 25 years, from 4% of the economy to 9% of the economy. This slide, which I apologize is being rather busy, but I'll blame CBO for that. The blue area, light blue, is Medicare and Medicaid spending. Clearly what this shows is that we as a society have promised a lot more in the way of benefits, and particularly benefits for the elderly and disabled, than we've historically been willing to tax ourselves. That's not to say that the revenue line is immutable, but it is the post-war experience. The key part to keep in mind in thinking about what I think is a pretty dismal long-range fiscal outlook is CBO has already assumed a significant decrease in what we've observed historically as the rate of increase in what's called excess health care costs, which is the extent to which health care costs are growing faster than per capita GDP. CBO is assuming that Medicare costs over the next 75 years will go up at 1.7%, Medicaid costs will go up at less than 1%, which is substantial improvement from what we've seen in the past. And the other interesting point to note is CBO comments that most of the increase in healthcare in Medicare and Medicaid spending increases are associated with rising costs per beneficiary, not increasing numbers of beneficiaries, nor with the aging of the population. So the point here is what we do to control the rate of excess health care cost growth is key to what we can afford. I want to turn now to briefly go through what I think are some of the key issues that a proposal such as the building blocks proposal poses, and hopefully ones that are relevant to the policy debate. I think the first order question is whether Part D of Medicare, which is a competitively bid system for prescription drugs, whether that's a viable model for a more comprehensive health plan. And currently, I would argue Part D has vigorously competing at-risk plans. There are very strong price signals that are set through the way the premiums are set and the bidding mechanism works, and beneficiaries seem to be responding to those plans and price signals. And lastly, and I think this is quite an important point, CMS, I think, has shown that it was actually capable of implementing the system and putting out a regulatory framework, which essentially is more akin to a regulation at a wholesale level, structuring the market rather than very detailed rules setting up complex payment systems. The other choice for Medicare, and I think Sibel is likely to talk more about this, is a more classic fee-for-service approach. Clearly, the building block proposal assumes both. The question I would pose about this is whether fee-for-service is viable from a number of perspectives as we increase by tens of millions of beneficiaries and the share of healthcare dollars that are being controlled by Medicare. The sheer complexity and information requirements of what are extraordinarily complex payment systems and the need to get literally tens of thousands of relative prices right, and if you don't, there can be significant distortions, I think is a real question, and the ability of CMS or literally anyone to get that right is a real significant issue. But even if CMS or whoever were administering this program got it right, the question is whether that could stand political scrutiny, whether the combination of interest groups and congressional intervention would let what would appear to be, if you would accept this, technically the best solution to stay in place, or whether we get further distortions. There clearly are other key choices. As Kathy mentioned, investments in health information technology, electronic medical records, public health, comparative effectiveness, those are things that are quite likely over time to improve health and health care. The question is whether they save money. At this point, there's very scant evidence of any that they save money. They may be good things, but the point here is we know an awful lot more about how to spend money and increase our costs, and we have great uncertainty about how to control costs and reduce costs. Similarly, on that vein, we know how to expand coverage. We know how to enrich subsidies. We know how to make programs more generous. The key question, and I think the key uncertainty, is our ability to not spend more, but to control the rate of spending, and in particular, the question of affordability goes back to being able to control the rate of healthcare costs. With that, let me quickly conclude by making four quick observations. The first, I want to go back and explicitly say I think this is a really important piece. It tries to deal in a comprehensive way with what normally doesn't go in the word with comprehensive with it, which is thinking about incremental changes and try to keep all the balls being juggled. That said, from my perspective, there are still open issues. That's not to say these are disqualifying issues. It just ones need further work. My other concern is I don't believe at this point, at least from a CBO perspective, the costs add up. Clearly, a critical piece is the ability to lower how much actual health care costs grow. And to some extent, even though the fiscal picture is somewhat dismal, CBO has already made some optimistic assumptions about what will happen in the future, and I would just caution we are historically better at spending money than figuring out how to control the rate of increase. A conclusion that's a personal judgment, and it's clearly a key judgment that other people could easily disagree with, is that I think Part D as a bidding approach is a more viable, more promising approach than adding to fee-for-service. But the last point that I want to make, with which I would hope no one on this panel or in this room would disagree, is that we literally need to increase the resources and capability of the federal government. With all due respect to my former colleagues at CMS, who I think do an extraordinarily good job, they are under-resourced, and the challenges they face exceed their capacity to deal with them under the current system. If we're going to put more weight on, more emphasis, more weight, new initiatives, I think we need to be very serious about providing the infrastructure that's required. I look forward to our discussion. Thank you.
It's great, Steve. Thanks very much. Now let's move to Sibel Bjorklund. On my far right, I love to say that. Sibel is the staff director for the Ways and Means Health Subcommittee. She has served over here on the Senate side, both with Senator Kennedy and Senator Daschle. She's been a Medicare analyst at what is now CMS. She's one of the few people on the Hill who embody the kind of institutional memory of Congress on health policy issues. So she's going to be a very valuable asset to the folks in the Ways and Means Committee and in the House over the next few months. And I'm pleased to say she's graced a number of alliance programs over the years. Sibel, thanks for joining us. Look forward to your comments.
Thank you, Ed. And thank you, Karen, for all the work you do on this and getting us here today. Gail leaned over and she said, you're to the right of me, too.
Is your mic on?
It's got a light on. But
Can you hear her in the back? Why don't you try the next microphone down, Sibel? I think you got a dead one.
Ominous. Pushing her even further right. Does this one work? Yes. Okay. I keep thinking one of these times I'll actually do a PowerPoint presentation, but I never managed to do it, so you don't have to see that. It also means I have to read my notes, which means I'm not quite sure what I'll say, because my writing is notoriously bad. I will say this is a tremendously important topic. I think it's very timely, and you know, we are thrilled when the Alliance and Commonwealth Fund decided to move forward with this. I think the turnout here is fantastic. There's a lot going on right now, and to see everybody here to discuss this right now, I think is really wonderful. I think there are a lot of issues, I think, that will start being discussed more as we move forward, obviously, toward the presidential and next year. And the hope, certainly, from Democrats is that health reform will become front and center, the most important domestic issue that we'll start dealing with. And certainly in our committee, we've begun a series of reform hearings, mostly around issues, laying the groundwork, not talking about solutions yet. I know finance is doing the same. I think energy and commerce is going to be moving forward. Help is staffing up. And there's really, I think, a level of excitement and anticipation that we hope there'll be some forward movement on this front next year. And to that end, I think even from the Ways and Means perspective, where we also have jurisdiction over tax, trade, other issues like that, not only is it a moral imperative that we're sort of the last industrialized, civilized nation to not cover all of our people. It's also an issue from a competitive standpoint with respect to our businesses here and abroad. When you look at the disparities that are developing between businesses that offer and don't offer here, the ones that do come to us quietly and say, it's not fair, I'm getting killed by my health costs, and, you know, the ones who are competing globally, you know, you need only look at the autos and the differential costs between Canada and here, or the fact that we pay more for healthcare than for steel, to know that this is hurting us and hurting our sectors in terms of how we go. So moving forward, I would say there are a whole lot of different ways to go about it. I would think that Democrats writ large, not that I could speak for any beyond my bosses, will in any event be looking, though, at combination approaches, you know, that people want to build on what works. I think that's one of the wonderful things with the building blocks proposal and other ones, and really be looking at sort of combination of shoring up what's out there today, as well as using public program expansions and other ways to make sure that people who don't have coverage through the work or elsewhere have a viable place to go. Chairman Stark, I work for Chairman Rangel and the subcommittee chairman, Chairman Pete Stark. And Stark is fond of saying, look, you know, our three broad brush goals were that everybody be covered, that providers and other people in the system be making a reasonable income. He's always quick to add it may not be desirable, but a reasonable income. And three, that everybody's in and paying according to their ability. For him, and I think for Chairman Rangel as well, and a good number of Democrats, Medicare may have its warts, but it is far preferable to what we've seen on private insurance on many fronts in terms of its efficiency, its effectiveness, and its equity. And for that reason, for us, it is often the first place we look when we're looking for a public program expansion. It doesn't have the variability of the state-based approaches. It's got the ultimate sort of inflexibility in many ways around the fee-for-service side of the program, what you're doing. We can talk about some of the other warts in a moment. And so, you know, Stark's main bill that he's pushing right now is a bill called AmeriCare, which Commonwealth last year evaluated a number of the leading congressional proposals, AmeriCare, the Wyden bill, Bush tax credits, AHPs and other small business plans, and out of all of those found that AmeriCare ranked the highest in terms of its ability to actually cover people, its ability to control costs, and sort of its again, overall effectiveness of where it was going to go. And in AmeriCare, we encourage employer-sponsored insurance. We do not believe in sort of tearing that down and starting over. That's too much instability for 170 million Americans. So we encourage it, but then we create a Medicare buy-in for people who don't have employer-sponsored insurance, and there are additional subsidies for low income. The Medicare buy-in, you know, is not a buy-in to Medicare proper as it exists right now. There are modifications to the benefit package to make sure, for example, that there's proper benefits for children and more prevention, other things. We include some of the things that Steve has mentioned in terms of being a critical element of a system, health, IT, comparative effectiveness, things like that. But there's really it's a pretty straightforward approach to where you could go here. Now, in fact, you would also see the reason I think Ed invited me to be here on behalf of the committee, variations on a theme. For many years, basically since the creation of CHIP, Chairman Stark and Senator Rockefeller have introduced a bill called MediKids, which takes a similar kind of approach to insure children. So the notion was if we were going to start with children, they took a bill, they did this with the enthusiastic support of the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Defense Fund, and basically said every child would leave a hospital upon birth with insurance. And the gist of it is if you could show that you have insurance already, then you're fine. If you can't show it, you are automatically enrolled in this program, and it comes off of your parents' taxes the following year until and unless they can show they have other coverage for you. Again, with a modified benefit package, and this is oversimplified, but this is getting to the gist of it. The other thing that we have looked at a lot sort of since the late 90s and continue to talk about is a Medicare buy-in for the under 65 near elderly. So whether you would say 55 to 64 or 60 to 64, basically looking at this population next to children is it's fast growing and it's intractable. It's very difficult to insure. If you've reached that age, you almost certainly have pre-existing conditions. The private market is not working well for these folks, and they are going to be aging into Medicare anyway, so why not give them an opportunity to buy in early? There are all sorts of levers you can do around that, whether you subsidize or don't subsidize. It's simply an option, whether you have the employers be able to buy in their early retirees. So, you know, there are a host of policy decisions, but it makes a lot of sense considering they're going to get there at some point. A key data point that came out recently that we find very compelling on this is, again, in this cohort, which is very difficult to insure through the current private market, what we found is people entering Medicare previously uninsured are costing the program a lot more. There's pent-up demand and anxiety coming in with poor health status, and it's a material cost to the program. So if people needed additional reasons to look at this as a population that needs extra help, that is one more point from our Medicare perspective where we need it. I should note, too, that most of these programs, when we've looked at them, we do them in a way that walls them off from the rest of Medicare. So to the extent people are worried about the financial challenges facing Medicare now, we need to be looking at those and addressing those. Creating these additional buy-ins can be done in a way that doesn't harm the program, and indeed it could help the program if you are keeping people healthy when they get on there or looking at other cross-subsidies if the risk pools turn out differently. I think, in sum, that we believe, contrary to what some folks think, that Medicare has been a tremendously effective and popular program among beneficiaries, American families, and despite grousing by a number of providers, most of them tell us categorically when asked that they prefer Medicare to the private insurers in terms of both reimbursement and management. And so many of the things that critics of Medicare blame on the program in terms of its benefit package not being fully modernized are really need to be laid at the feet of Congress. That we've set up the program in a way that we need to be the ones to act to make improvements in it. So on the prescription drug front, there were efforts in the early to mid-70s by Senator Kennedy and others to add prescription drugs then. It just simply took us 20, 30 years to do it because of political opposition in some camps and some of the special interest concerns. So there are other avenues, I will say, prevention. There's been a lot of talk in the last 10 years about modernizing the program with prevention, and we did some of that in the BBA. And we, in the CHAMP Act last year in the House side, went ahead and said, let's give the Secretary the authority to modernize the program without us. Let's cut ourselves out of the equation and say, Mr. Secretary, you may add these preventive benefits if the Preventive Services Task Force or other people think that they're wise for this population. Add them without us. Let's waive the cost sharing for it, because last we looked, we don't have a problem with too many colonoscopies here. and it doesn't cost very much to do that. And yet, in the language that we're going to be considering this year, because of ideological concerns really from folks who don't want to improve the program at all, they don't want to do it. I think they'd prefer to still come out and say that it's a 1965 program, that it's stuck, that we can't move forward. So it's very, very difficult to make some of those changes, but I guarantee if everybody were in, there'd be an even more vested interest in making things work as they should. So with that, I will say, we believe the keys for reform are finding a program that's available, accessible, affordable for all, that it's portable and easily administratable. And we think that Medicare fits that bill. The administration stuff I won't gloss over as being easy. I think Gail will address that. But where there's a will, there's a way. And this, to us, seems to be working a lot better than the private market. The private market would need tremendous regulation that I don't think they'd want to endure to really work for all Americans. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Sibel. We're going to turn now to Gail Walensky. She's an economist. She's a senior fellow at Project HOPE. She also probably understands Medicare and health insurance as well as anybody in the field. She's been the chair of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission. She's actually run Medicare when she was administrator of what is now CMS. She's looked at a whole lot of Medicare-related proposals over the years, and we're very pleased that you've accepted our invitation to share your thoughts about the ones we've been hearing today. Gail?
Thank you. Is this on?
Yes.
Yes, I do really love the notion that I have Sybil to my right, now my far right. I was late, excuse me for coming in late, but I was speaking at the Medicaid Congress, my other hat that I frequently wear. I was asked to comment about the administrative issues that the proposal raises, and I'm going to start there, but I had a couple of other observations that I want to offer as well. When you look at the building block notion, and I hope you'll forgive me of saying this, I actually like the earlier version slightly better, but it's really a values question of how you want to move forward in terms of extending coverage to the population without coverage. And I honestly think that really is the answer more than could CMS be able or a CMS-like agency able to run this. And I think the answer is, yes, it could run this if it were provided with the support structure that it would need in order to do that. So my bottom line advice is I don't think this is beyond the capability of the agency to do if it had proper funding and expansion. I think it has shown an ability to be quite responsive in what has frequently been a very stressful environment when asked to implement a very large number of changes in the existing Medicare program, such as happened after the Balanced Budget Act in 1997, and when it was asked to do something very different, which was to implement the Part D Medicare, which was an entirely different kind of mechanism, showed an ability to do so. Not that there weren't problems that resulted in the rollout, the education campaign, and some of the early parts of the administration, for example, of Part D. But all in all, it seems to me, when you look at how that program rolled out, it was pretty good. And by the second year, it was quite good. So I don't think the argument against this kind of a proposal ought to be it is asking an agency to do something it couldn't do if properly funded. I do think the issue about whether or not CMS has been properly funded in the past to do what it's done is a very legitimate one. I have signed on early on with a bunch of signatories now, and I can't remember which year, that Congress shouldn't keep asking the agency to do more and more without providing a commensurate level of support for the administration of these programs. It is just asking for really bad things to happen. And I think one of the fundamental changes that needs to happen if this is going to be a serious concept is that we have to move away from the separation where the benefits are funded from as an entitlement and the administrative support comes out of the discretionary budget, a completely different committee. Now, for many reasons, my plea is to do something to modify both pieces. That is, I think, one of the very serious problems that we have in Medicare, which has an unfunded liability that somewhere, I think the number was $36 trillion. It was a very big number. That we might want to change the budgeting process where the Congress is forced to review what it's going to do about the entitlement part on a periodic basis. There are a number of Republican and Democratic analysts that have come out saying that kind of notion. And similarly, in the same kind of vein, it is unreasonable to fund the administrative part of CMS out of a budget that is going to be directly competing for support for LIHEAP, the low-income support for elderly for their fuel or for funding some of the various supports for low-income populations or education or whatever. I mean, that is just doomed to always undercutting the support that the program needs. So if this is going to be a serious kind of a proposal, you have to get around that. I think we may be able to look at what happens to Massachusetts as that folds out to see what kind of administrative burdens and what kind of individuals are needed, how costly it is, where the stresses are. There are already some interesting learning experiences coming out of Massachusetts, like it's really a good idea to have a better count of your uninsured before you start in terms of being able to know what you're going to spend. I mean, that's not a swipe, really, of saying other than if you get the count wrong, don't be surprised if you get the money wrong. And there are a lot of other related issues that this kind of a proposal would result in. I do want to caution that we need to remember Medicare, by and large, is suffering from the same kinds of stresses as the rest of the healthcare system, minus the problem with regard to the uninsured, and that we need to focus as much or more on what we're going to do to slow down the spending growth rate in healthcare and to improve quality and clinical outcomes and patient safety. And although it is always tempting during an election cycle to equate healthcare reform primarily, not exclusively, but primarily with expansion coverage, please, please remember that these other issues affect the 85% of us with coverage as well as the 15% of us without coverage. And in this vein, Medicare really doesn't look a whole lot better than the rest of the healthcare system, and in large part because it is even more reliant on traditional fee-for-service, which, as I don't have to tell the Commonwealth Fund, it is investing a lot of resources in trying to help design a more accountable and responsive healthcare delivery system. So the one sort of amusing part that I felt reading through the document is all the glorification of Medicare, the last bastion of primarily a la carte fee-for-service siloed medicine, and we surely don't want to really go forward with that if we don't have to. Now, I know there was an option for an integrated delivery system. I saw that. But I think we might want to get a little more serious about how, if we are going to use this, which is going to clearly cost a lot of money, I don't believe Lewin estimates for a moment. I can't echo strongly enough what Steve had said, that these numbers are not credible. But whatever it is, we need to wrap our arms around these other issues and figure out how we're going to make them as much a part of what we do. I think the buy-in for near elderly is not such an unreasonable idea as a near elderly person myself, although I happen to fortunately have health insurance. But we have to decide, is this going to be actuarially fair? And if so, is it going to be subsidized? And if so, for whom and how financed? And, oh, yeah, don't forget the $36 trillion unfunded liability for the rest of Medicare. Be very careful about giving too much more to put on this program that we don't know how we're going to pay for. So interesting. People want to throw darts at it. There are lots of places to throw darts at. But I would say don't hang your hat on that CMS can't administer it. If given the proper tools, I don't think that's the problem. Thank you.
That's terrific. Thank you. This has been so far, even so far, without any Q&A in exchange, a terrific discussion. I would invite you now to repair to the microphones to ask questions if you would like. Pull out those green question cards, and let me just mention in passing, there's also a blue evaluation form in your packets that I would urge you to pull out and begin to fill out as we start this part of the program so that we can make these programs better for you as we go along. I would also invite our panelists, if you have some pressing point that you would like to make in response to something that you've heard, you should feel free to indicate that, and we'll try to accommodate it. Meanwhile, we have a questioner who will identify himself and direct the question to somebody if you would like.
Michael Gluck, I'm an independent health policy consultant at the moment. And my question builds on, in part on Gail's suggestions about what to do about the administrative capacity of Medicare in general. And as we think about expansions, but is really broader. And you know, over the years I've been impressed with the consistency of attitudinal research that's really documented the public acceptance and support of some of the fundamental values that underlie Medicare. It's a universality, the notion of intergenerational economic benefits in the financing of healthcare, protection of choice of providers, broad-based financing, those sorts of things. And yet, at the same time, we are living with tremendous skepticism about the capacity of government and some of the ideas that were the critique that was embodied in Congressman Price's remarks about the potential effect of government policies on the practice of healthcare. My question is sort of just generally, if we were to go down this path, how important is that barrier, that skepticism and concern, and how do we overcome it? And that really is directed at anyone on the panel. Yes.
Okay. Far right, far left.
I'll just try to give it's such a large question. You know, I think confronting a potential new way of approaching insurance, we have one state, the state of Massachusetts, who has set up something that never existed before. It's quasi-public. You could say it's quasi-private. But their connector was funded in it with an upfront administrative to get it up and running, and it now runs off an administrative fee. So what Gail's point of self-financing the running of it. I think government can do very creative things, and we've seen Medicare do it in the past. What we need to have is a will to say there's something both in the private sector and the public sector that we all could gain from if we can envision a different way of approaching some of these problems. So I think it just as we were able to take leaps forward, we could do it, but we don't yet have a consensus of what is going to bind us together.
I mean, I think there is really not the consensus for the non-poor or the at least above the middle class in terms of how and what and who finances the expansion. Not the issue that people shouldn't have health insurance coverage. I mean, I think there is a widespread belief that that is there. So the notion of how you try to create a support for a particular policy is very important, and it's why seeing what happened in Massachusetts, it's the applauding the efforts of Wyden and Bennett. Not that I and most other people have looked at it, have a lot of comments, areas that they find or may find objectionable, but it represents an attempt to try to build a coalition that comes out of the middle to see whether or not you can't be responsive to an issue. And that to me is really the most serious challenge. And it's particularly gets challenging because we're about to go for the next 6 months into how many grenades can we lob at each other? And then the election will be over. There'll be a two-month hiatus. And people are supposed to go make nice and solve these very difficult issues that require a real sense of willingness to give and take in order to solve a problem. And, by the way, come up with some substantial amount of money, which is not obvious. Some of us are somewhat dubious about where the big dollar part of healthcare reform comes from in terms of how to start this process. But, you know, those are different kind of questions, I mean, that to ask. There's not the easy answer about how you try to create that kind of environment, other than a sense either one side is so dominating, the political structure, which is 65% or 70% dominance in at least the Senate, because you need to get over those 60 votes, and the White House, that you don't have to really build a coalition. And any other time, I mean, that's called Medicare and Medicaid's passage in 1965, But I don't think that's going to happen. So it means getting serious about putting a coalition together that really can create support for something, something for everybody to hate and something for everybody to love, but enough sense that this would move us forward. And actually, Part D Medicare fit that description as well. It was as good as was going to come out of the Congress in the period of 2000 to 2008, and with a lot of effort and push at the last minute, went over. And people can debate whether at the end of the day they were better off or worse off or not, but those are the kinds of issues that we'll have to decide going forward.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, I had two ideas that I would be, oh, I'm sorry, I'm Joanne Lynn, and I'm a geriatrician and health services researcher. And I had two ideas that it would be fun to hear you all bat around. The first is that if we're serious about patient-centered priorities, and everybody seems to claim to be serious about that, when we are old and sick and frail and ill on an everyday basis for a few years, our priorities are not those of the current Medicare program. Our priorities are much more PACE-like, continuity, comprehensiveness, supportive services, never getting a pressure ulcer, never having a fall, and much less high-tech interventions and whiz-bang gizmos from me and my medical partners. If we were building a care system that was actually responsive to the needs of patients, then the current Medicare program is actually better suited to the near elderly than it is to a large proportion of the elderly. And it would seem that we could take the opportunity to begin to notice that and make the financing match a delivery system that is actually accommodating to the needs of people who are terribly disabled, living for a substantial period of time ahead of death. So that's one idea, is whether we could take the current round of debate as an opportunity to begin to segment Medicare rather than thinking of it as one population. And a second is that if we wanted to cover the near elderly, we might be able to use some wisdom from some other countries and notice that we also have an enormous shortfall in direct caregiving, and that we are pretty much out there alone as a country that provides almost no support to family and voluntary caregiving. If we, maybe as a first step, maybe as the only step, started to tie coverage to providing caregiving, we might add the sense that these are especially meritorious beneficiaries. So if you said, for example, people 55 to 65 who are providing more than 40 hours a week of care to a Medicare beneficiary, would be eligible for Medicare coverage if they have no other way of getting covered. Once upon a time, about 10 years ago, we costed that out as a rough estimate. At that time, it was only about $250 million. I mean, it's spare change in the federal budget. But it would begin to have us examine what happens when you expand Medicare, and can we handle it for an especially meritorious group of people whose work actually helps reduce the costs in Medicare.
Interesting ideas, not surprisingly, Joanne. Response from any of the panelists?
I'll be pleased to comment, because I think that the excellent observations, and I would suggest that, as you said in your opening sentence or two, it is a lack of responsiveness of the current system. And that's because the current system is responsive to the individuals that are driving it, and the people that are driving it are not patients. And so we do not have a system that is responsive to geriatrics. We do patients. We do not have a system that's responsive to caregivers, because patients aren't driving the system. If, in fact, we were concerned about a patient-centered system and having a system that were responsive to patients, the only way for a system to respond to patients is if patients have power. The only way, I believe, for them to have power is to have them own their health insurance policy regardless of who's paying. That's why I believe that the pillars that I outlined are the ones that get us to the point that we want to get. Because as my son, who's 18 years old, the last thing he's thinking about right now is health insurance. But as you talk about your geriatric patients, they have completely different needs than my son. You can't fit the 18-year-old and the geriatric patient into the same system and have it be responsive to each.
Joanne, your work in dealing with people at end of life and issues like that, clearly the question of how Medicare deals with social and complex social needs that are outside of an acute care benefit package is, or any healthcare system, is an important social issue. The problem, I think, becomes one from the question of matching the social need and social value with the question of the cost, and particularly the question of when you're dealing with a federal benefit package that's written as an entitlement package, and how one then separates out the, at the margin, people who would not otherwise get care versus people who are now getting care that's informal care, which are now monetizing, versus other forms of expansion of benefits, which may be a social good, but it makes the problem of cost, I think, harder. And so I think your question, in a broader sense, illustrates the challenges that Kathy and Karen have been trying to take on, which is, where do you draw the lines? And in some sense, I think, Gail, it would be fair to say that your and my observations, to some extent, are applauding the comprehensiveness of the effort, but to note that there's a problem with line drawing and there's some really significant questions that haven't been addressed. And the I think this is a classic case, and I don't know what the judgment is, but it's clearly a policy judgment of where we may have the better be the enemy of the good.
Yes, go ahead, Karen.
I know we've got a lot of questions, so it won't take much time, but I think the one thing we all agree on here is we want a patient-responsive, patient-centered system. So a little bit the question is whether people are better off taking their bundle of money and trying to find it on their own, or whether the Medicare program really needs to try to be a leading innovator on delivery system reform and developing different models of care for the work, Joanne, that you've done on the different stages. And certainly I think this whole concept of a patient-centered medical home is an important beginning, and obviously Medicare is in the throes of designing a demonstration of that given the legislation that Congress enacted in December of 2006. But I think we'll have to evolve that concept to have a somewhat different model for patients at the end of life, patients with complex conditions but not at the end of life, and those, as you say, who are the relatively healthy, whether it's near elderly or those newly eligible for the current Medicare program. And then to link that with payment reform, so there is the incentive to make prudent use of resources but have bundled payment with greater flexibility for trading off the kinds of services that are used to reach that, to allocate those funds.
If I can ask the forbearance of the folks at the microphones, I wanted to pick up a couple of questions that were actually referred to indirectly by what Joanne was talking about. You made the observation that the Medicare program seemed better suited to the near elderly than to the elderly, and a couple of the questions come from the viewpoint of worrying about the impact of the proposal to allow a buy-in to Medicare on the fiscal soundness of Medicare, on the pool of risk for Medicare, and how the financing mechanism for that particular part of the plan might work. And I wonder if anybody would like to respond to that. Kathy?
I'll try to do it in a short way. And I think, Gail, you pointed out in the article we didn't do a lot of modernizing of Medicare. And there were a few things. One, health affairs has a word limit, so we define. But I think we are absolutely talking about a modernized Medicare, a different way of paying. And one of the issues, even with the buy-in, was buying in not to the type of benefit structure that currently exists, where when you buy basic Medicare now, you need to buy two other supplements. You would never have that. You don't have that in the group. So it was both trying to set up a more comprehensive benefit package, by comprehensive meaning all the pieces were together. And that buy-in was set, the estimates were an actuarial fair premium. So it would not be, as Sibel said, it's not buying in to the trust fund per se. It's buying in at a premium level. So it doesn't add to, it's not a new entitlement. So that's the way the vision was. But I think if you read more broadly some of what we put out in a recent report called Bending the Curve that is available on our website, trying to think of not just what the benefit package looks like, but the way providers are being paid for benefits. As Karen mentioned, a medical home, Medicare is talking about paying differently. Medicare was the innovator in bundling payments for hospitals with DRGs. There is a potential of moving away in an incremental way with you offering new ways of paying so that you can get more comprehensive geriatric care or chronic cares where physicians can be working with nurses. And we see some of that innovation happening both in the private sector but also internationally as other countries are also searching for a way of pulling the system back together and having it be more coordinated. We need that innovation in Medicare, we need it in the private sector, and something like a connector that allows the two to play off each other offers the possibility for stimulating more creative and constructive directions in the future. So that the vision wasn't just coverage based on the all, but it was coverage plus a broader set of system reforms, because I think we absolutely have to do it. I just want to say one thing about the Lewin estimates, too, because Lewin, if you look at the estimates, the coverage alone that was in the proposal in health affairs wasn't fully funded, and they absolutely, in out years, if we don't do something to slow the growth, the federal costs accelerate. So we've done some offsets for that initial financing, but I think coverage without the supplemental system approaches, we will find ourselves, how do we maintain the premium? How do we maintain the subsidies? So there is that interactive out year where the coverage proposal not coupled with payment reform would be expensive over time.
Karen, you want to add to that, and then Sibel?
Yes, just since our Lewin colleagues, as far as I know, aren't here to defend themselves, I might also address this fact that the Medicare extra benefit package has a premium about 30% below what employers are paying. Kind of shocked me the first time I saw it, and we probed quite a bit on that. But when you think about it a little bit, Medicare's administrative costs are 2%. For employers, it's 15 to 20%. Actually, if you're talking about the small individual or small business market, you may be 30 to 50% overhead on top of that. So you're trading those administrative costs for Medicare. Then there's the fact that Medicare pays hospitals about 15% less than commercial payers. It pays physicians about 20% less than commercial payers. So if you've got savings of 15% or so on administrative costs and you've got savings of 15 to 20% on provider payment, the fact that you wind up with a 30% savings on premiums is really not as surprising once you parse it out. So I'll leave it to Lewin to defend their estimates, and certainly one will see at some point in time if this ever moves forward what a CBO prices it at. But those are some of the elements that go into those kinds of differentials.
Yes, go ahead, Sibel.
Well, and I was, is it on? Yes, can't tell. I would just make the same case there. I mean, one of the reasons when, you know, Chairman Stark and Chairman Rangel and others who have been at this for a long time keep returning to variations on a theme around Medicare is just that in terms of the ability on the efficiency side. But I wanted to actually just reiterate that for us, too, although I focused on sort of Medicare as a vehicle given the topic, when we look at reform, it really is a three-legged stool, cost, coverage, and quality. And it goes back to Gail's point, too, that as goes Medicare, so goes the rest of the system, and vice versa. You cannot tease out a lot of the cost issues we're having in Medicare from what's happening elsewhere. So that is very much on our frame of mind as well. And I think when you look at Medicare, the other thing, both for as it exists today and as a model for the future, there's a huge continuum between completely a la carte fee-for-service payments and giving private insurers a capitated amount saying, go do whatever you want. And there's a lot that needs to be done, and people have tried through the years, and we had provisions in our CHAMP Act last year on this too, to get at bundling and feedback to providers and other kinds of things, medical home, to more fully integrate and coordinate care for beneficiaries who are in a fee-for-service program, whether Medicare or somewhere else, that are a much more modern way of looking at it than the a la carte, but still don't necessarily offload with the attendant issues that we've got in the Medicare Advantage program.
Yes, good. Gail?
Quick comment. The first is I would be willing to wager at least a good dinner at the restaurant of your choice that the CBO estimate looks nothing like the Lewin estimate. Let me just give you a couple of observations as to why I think there are some areas that just don't seem to make intuitive sense. It is true that you are going to allow the Medicare pricing and that is lower. But, of course, as we know from Medicare Part B, having pricing is not the same as slowing down expenditures. Part B has been managing its 10 or 12% growth, even though Medicare controls the prices. So it just is a clear reminder how what we fight most in this country is the volume and mix of services, and we sometimes get too hung up on the prices. The second is you will recall that there seemed to be unanimous agreement that Medicare has absolutely starved the administrative structure. And if you want anything like this, you're going to have to pony up a lot more money. So for God's sakes, stop holding up Medicare as the model of administrative efficiency. It's as low as it has been, one, because the Medicare spending part, the denominator, has grown so rapidly, and two, because it is frigging starved by the administration and the Congress, and that's why the amount is so small. So at least on the same panel, don't say that we need to be serious about how we're going to support the agency and at the same time exalt what we see now for its low program. I mean, we need to at least get through one session without having that contradiction.
Can I just say, just quickly, you know, my boss has always put his money where his mouth is, and he has repeatedly gone to APROPS, even under hostile administrations, to ask for more money for the agency for just that reason. My point is only it's actually less than 2% in admin. You could triple the resources and still be far more efficient than any of the private sector admin costs. So we are absolutely in favor, and I love the idea of a mandatory draw, but there are probably other committees that don't. But
The two people at the microphones have been very patient. And I'm going to start with the gentleman at the far microphone.
I have perhaps two questions and then a general comment. The first question
I'll bet
is,
you have a name.
Oh, my name is Walton Dumas, and I'm from the American Enterprise Institute. And I'm all for covering the uninsured. I think that's great. But I have a problem with the national building blocks approach, and I don't know if I have a problem with it yet. So my question for Kathy is, under the national building blocks approach, would you allow private insurers to compete in the national individual insurance market?
Yes. You know, the external to the connector and internal to the connector, private insurance would still exist. So it could be offering either through
Right, but would you open it up restricting it at state lines?
Or
that's
could
my
be
question.
We didn't change anything about the state jurisdictions other than saying the connector is going to only operate in a region where the insurance market rules for everyone say it's not risk related to health status so that there's an adjusted community rate. So for a state or region to do that, so it would be like a Massachusetts has those kinds of insurance rules, and they have insurance companies competing with each other.
Right. So if you let the government sort of provide insurance to a national pool where you distribute risk over the entire nation of the individual insurance, which is something that, to my understanding, private insurance would like to do but isn't allowed to, then you have them coming into a marketplace that they don't currently exist in and competing on a level that you don't allow private actors to compete. And so my question is that legal and or ethical to do?
The rules would, you know, I'll try to understand the question, but if the rules are the same inside and outside the connector, and I think if you imagine what this does, in a Netherlands, for example, they have competing private plans working under a national framework. The plans operate in Amsterdam as well as other parts of the country. Some are nationwide, but you actually by changing some of the rules and having everyone in, you probably lower the underwriting costs and some of the overhead costs in the small group and individual market by pooling those markets. You're not really doing anything to undermine carriers. They could be offering across multiple state lines or through a national, either way, as they do now. The markets are very concentrated. All the big plans we see are operating in multiple states. So they're both operating in a state market and in a national market, and this doesn't really change anything about that.
Okay, well, as long as they can compete in the same markets, that's fine. My next is a general comment, and it seems to me, and, you know, I don't have a PhD in economics, but if you are going to increase demand by covering more people and you're going to decrease payment to people who provide the supply, you're going to eventually run into supply problems, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, maybe not in the next 10 years, but at some point, you'll run into supply problems, not enough physicians.
Would one of our PhD economists like to respond to that?
It really depends on whether or not you view this as a public utility model where everybody who's in at a point in time is enfranchised in, or recognize that in a world in which you may have individuals who are providing less than appropriate care or poor quality care, that there are some individuals in some markets that are going to be pushed either to relocate, to do things that they're not doing now that they don't prefer to do, but that we shouldn't look at this in a static world. People ask a lot of times whether or not we have a shortage of physicians, and the answer is it depends on how they practice. If they practice like they're practicing now, we'll have shortages in a number of areas. If they adopt very different practice styles and look more like the Mayo Clinics, Intermountain Healthcare, Leahy Clinics, it's not clear to me that we have shortages in those areas. What we need to understand, if we aggressively actually try to put the information out so there's much better information about what provides medical value and reward the clinicians and institutions who provide good quality care, are responsive to their patients, have good patient satisfaction, there is more than enough money in the system to take care of that. It is some of the other institutions or individuals who might find a lot of downward pressure if we have a much more responsive system. But I wouldn't worry. And when we get the kind of estimates of how much aggressively we do in this country compared to what other people do, there's a lot of potential for learning how to treat smarter and learning how to spend smarter and not worrying about shortages unless we somehow feel we have to enfranchise everybody who's out there who's not responsive to the new pressures.
Steve?
I agree with what Gail said. I just want to add a slightly different perspective, but I think it's entirely consistent, which is the work of Jack Wenberg, Elliot Fisher, and so on. And in their seminal article in the Annals of Internal Medicine about 4 or 5 years ago, one of the most important findings they had was more care is not better care, and there's some suggestion that more care may actually be worse. So that I think clearly there, the question of how one deals with the redistribution and the winners and losers and disruption of moving to less intense use of care is going to be an extraordinarily messy and politically fraught set of changes. But as a theoretical issue, clearly if we knew how to move to efficient levels of care and to avoid supply-sensitive services to adopt their framework, their estimates that they've done that suggest that would lower Medicare spending by about 30%. Now, the question how you move there is an entirely different question, but I think the important point is because of the way the current system works, we clearly have incentives for people to provide care in ways that are not patient-centric, that are not best for the patients. And that allows the potential, if we can figure out how to organize and harness that, and I think that's a lot of the work that trying to build a high-performing health system that group is focused on, and there are other efforts, obviously. But I think that becomes a real mediating factor before you get to the almost Malthusian kind of implication of your question.
Congressman Price.
Very, very briefly, more care isn't necessarily better care, but no care is no care. And the sense that there may be a challenge to the supply of providers out there at some distant date isn't the case. The challenge is today. 25% of the practicing physicians out there who see Medicare patients are limiting the number of Medicare patients that they see. If this is such a wonderful system, it's imperative that we ask the question, why? Why are those folks not seeing new Medicare patients? Find the closest person that you know, parent, grandparent, aunt, uncle, spouse, who has come of Medicare age in the past year, and ask them, did you have any difficulty finding a new primary care physician for Medicare? And the likelihood is that they did. So we have a challenge to the supply right now, which makes it imperative that we look at the system and answer the questions, why is it that providers are not universally participating in the program?
On a quick note on that is just that, again, as goes Medicare, so goes the rest of the system. I have FEHBP Blue Cross. It's widely talked about as the gold standard. And here in D.C., I do not have a pediatrician or an internist who takes it. I am self-paying to the tune of thousands of dollars out of an FSA on top of a $14,000 a year premium paid by the government and myself for primary care for a healthy family.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you. Jonathan
Peck, patient.
Institute for Alternative Futures. Across the Hill earlier this year at a hearing, I heard the phrase hollow government syndrome applied to an agency that's had more mandates put on it without more capacity built into it. And I've heard today from three of you on this panel that CMS may be to some degree at risk for this kind of hollow government syndrome. I'd like to ask, how big is that risk in your view over the next few years?
And with the qualification, with or without additional duties. Go ahead.
This is not a new issue. This is not a new challenge or issue for CMS, and it happens for the reasons I suggested, is that the administrative support is funded in isolation from running the program and competes against the rest of discretionary funding for the government. I think it has been a long-term problem and exists today and will exist unless there's a change in the funding mechanism.
GAO probably about 8 or 9 years ago put Medicare on the high-risk list. Everybody. For exactly that reason. And I think at that time, that was a 2000 report, The average tenure of an administrator or an acting administrator was shockingly short, counting the acting administrators. And I think the tenure has gotten no better in the last 7 or 8 years. It's not just a resource problem, although clearly resources are a major issue. And you know, it's hard for an OMB budget examiner to say that, but clearly resources are a major issue and the lack of sufficient resources. But it's also leadership, it's management, it's I can't begin to tell you how beleaguered people inside CMS feel. They are, when they get it right, when they do exactly what Congress asked them to do, they get beaten upon. It is a very tough environment. I've worked in a lot of different places, and CMS is a really hard environment. People get paid an awful lot more money to do other things in an awful lot nicer environment. And until we deal with the policy and management challenges, as well as the resource challenges, we really do have a dramatic risk. And I will add one other thing. My last job at OMB, I was a career assistant director, and I was responsible for privatization, among other things, in the end of the first Bush administration. And we had a doctrine of inherently governmental services. Among other things, contractors didn't set policy. Federal officials set policy. Because of the way CMS is hollowed out, it is my perception that an awful lot of policymaking gets done for a variety of reasons by contractors, not by the institutional core. So if you try to look at why did you do this in trying to simulate one of their complex payment systems, the answer oftentimes is it's in the SAS code that was written by a contractor, and we don't know. and I don't mean to embarrass CMS here. This is not in any way suggesting that there's something wrong with them. It is a statement of fact of what I think is a hollowing out of government that's occurred over the last 15 years.
I saw Stu Gutterman of the Commonwealth Fund, late of CMS, nodding in approval there. we have time for just one more question that I'm going to draw from cards, and I'd ask you as we finish up here to pull out those blue evaluation forms and fill them out for us. This question is addressed nominally to – oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead,
sorry,
Stu.
I had to. I wasn't going to say anything, but I wasn't nodding. I was shaking my head the other way.
I see.
Actually, it's my perception that most of the decisions at CMS are made by the political appointees, and they're implemented, you know, pretty much by the career people, you know, with help from contractors in terms of some of the parameters. But I think they're pretty – my perception was they were pretty carefully thought out last I looked. There's obviously some conflict occasionally between the political appointees and the career people at CMS, and that's going to happen.
Okay. You certainly had the right of personal privilege, as they say. This question is nominally addressed to Congressman Price, and we'll give him first crack at it, but I think it raises a point that everybody on the panel has at least touched on, and I would welcome other responses. The question asks Congressman Price how your patient-centered approach controls cost increases. And I would ask more generally, we've heard from many of you about how important and even overriding the cost question is. And in lieu of all of the things that you dismiss as not working, what is it that you propose to try to make this system a more efficient, cost-effective way of doing business? We'll start with Congressman Price.
Thanks, Ed. Let me thank you all again for allowing me to participate on this, and I just want to toss my remarks in favor of the folks at CMS and the job that they're doing. I wouldn't have that job for anything. I don't envy the work that they're doing. Can you imagine having your boss change every four to eight years without your control at all, and you got no control over it? I wouldn't have it for anything. How do you control costs? Well, you got to answer the question: what drives costs? What's driving costs in healthcare? In order to figure out how you're going to control costs, and what drives costs in healthcare, our healthcare system is no different than that which drives costs in any other business or endeavor, and primarily it's taxation, litigation, and regulation. So if you control the issues of taxation, litigation, regulation, and litigation not just in the liability system for medical liability, but in the ability of physicians to police their own ranks. Right now they are unable to do so, I would suggest, because of liability issues. So taxation, litigation, regulation it adds remarkable amounts to the cost of health care. And it's also the second question that one has to answer in talking about costs is what should healthcare cost in our nation? I don't know what that number ought to be, but I know how you get to that number in a free society, and it is allowing free individuals to determine how much they wish to spend on healthcare. That's the way that you get to the right answer. Is it 16% of GDP? I don't know. Is it 20%? I don't know. Is it 12%? I don't know. But I do know how you get to that the answer to that question. And it is not, the answer to that question is not one that ought to be determined by individuals in the surrounding environs. The answer to that question is to allow patients to determine how much they wish to spend on health care.
Thank you. Others? Sabella and then Karen?
Well, I think, you know, again, our concern is in terms of the individual empowerment around cost. I think a lot of where you are going to try to influence cost once you have better data is around clinicians and helping clinicians be better clinicians as they take care of their patients, relieving them of some of the business obligations and allowing them to do what they were trained to do. Most of them didn't go to business school. They went to medical school, but there's still so much uncertainty around what works and what doesn't work. And, you know, patients are bad consumers. Partly they don't have good information, but you're in a vulnerable state,
and there's a mismatch of the information that you have. And I think people are fooling themselves if they think that putting the patients on the hook for this is going to materially change. It may choose people to force people to forego care that they need, and they present sicker and actually increase total spending. But basically, you know, we believe that although information is a good thing, it's never going to be like buying a car. And I don't care what car Gail buys. That's her business. But I do actually care what she buys in terms of insurance, because in the market we have today, if there's a massive opting to high deductible plans, the rest of us who don't want to opt there have our choices affected by other people's choices. So it's a very dynamic and different market from a traditional market, and I think we have to be very aware of that looking forward when you look at the incentives.
Well, I think there's no silver bullet that solves the cost problem, but I think there are a number of very real options for slowing the rate of growth in health care outlays. And if we do a number of things that make sense and we start soon, they will have a major cumulative effect. Just to give some examples, the churning of insurance coverage, people enrolling, disenrolling, re-enrolling creates costs. We need greater standardization. We funded a study to look at administrative costs, and one of the greatest costs of physician time are formularies. So the patient gets a prescription, goes to the pharmacy, it's not covered by that plan, so they got to call the doc, change the prescription, so that physician doesn't know what's going to be accepted at the time that they write it. IT, I think we've seen some of the CBO analysis of that, but in the bending the curve, we designed it with real teeth, and that came from having an assessment on insurance companies to go to state governments to really help small physician practices and safety net providers that are not going to be adopting IT anytime soon. Without that kind of support on comparative effectiveness, it's linked, again, in the Lewin estimates to real teeth, that cost sharing, that you pay the difference if you want something that's no more effective but costs more, whether it's a drug, device, or procedure, you pay the difference. So I think those are things that we can do. But in my own view, the fundamental secret to dealing with healthcare costs is delivery system reform, and that means valuing primary care. When I look at the difference between the U.S. and other countries, the real difference is the differential between primary care and specialty care. And I think for Medicare, we need to think about new provider types going beyond just physicians and hospitals to really having group primary care group practices, multi-specialty group practices, hospitalist systems, systems that have their own physicians, integrated delivery systems, and we need new bundled payment mechanisms that are attractive to those kinds of organizations to take accountability both for care and health outcomes, but also the prudent use of resources. So I think, in my own view, that's the key to the future. The Commonwealth Fund is working on two reports, one that we anticipate releasing in July on options for reorganizing the healthcare delivery system, and one that Kathy's hard at work on that she's looking at me for the date that I'm going to promise it, but early next year on a path to high performance, which is a combination of all of these strategies that it takes us to really get to where we ought to expect and ought to demand that we go as a country. Thank you.
It's an area where actually there is large areas of overlap in terms of not only spending more in terms of knowing the value of what is being provided and constructing reimbursement systems so that you reward those areas that have high value and you let people buy up for those areas where they're low value. I think it's an area where we could combine what is physicians' interest traditionally in terms of liability reform and begin to provide protection for physicians who have a standard set of patient safety measures and follow clinical guidelines developed by their colleges, that they be not subject to punitive damages unless there is clear evidence of criminal negligence. That this would take away one of the drivers that frustrates many physicians, that not only are they not incented to do what counts and to do it well and be responsive to their patients, but they put themselves at some legal liability if there's a bad outcome, that, and they don't have that kind of a protection. It seems to me a very clear way to marry the interest in evidence-based medicine that has created interest on both the right and the left with providing something that has been a thorn in the side of clinicians, and to recognize that this is going to be an iterative process over time. It is discouraging, but not surprising in many ways, that CBO has taken the position that health IT per se is not going to save money, but particularly in terms of comparative clinical effectiveness, may allow the mechanism you need in order to implement that. And I do think that we can use payment strategies to help fund the adoption of IT for groups that are not likely to have access to capital, like small groups of physicians, particularly rural physicians or small rural hospitals, perhaps. And just remember that we have enormous numbers of freestanding cardiac and orthopedic hospitals and imaging centers, a clear reflection of a misalignment in payment. And if we begin to use some of that same kind of strategy of changing what we're paying for, we can help provide the money that it would be needed to reconfigure the delivery system. We know it works. We just don't like what we've done thus far.
Very good. Anybody else? Okay. Well, this has been a session at which I have learned a great deal, I want you to know. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Fund for its support and co-sponsorship of this program, as well as its contribution to the panel. Take a special word for the fund and the Alliance staff who worked on this. It was, as you see, a multifaceted discussion, and it was multifaceted in the ways in which it came together. And thank you for your hard work. I want to just commend all of the panelists, and I particularly want to say a kind word about Congressman Price in absentia. He had another meeting he had to go to. He sort of walked into the lion's den of the economists and came out largely unscathed, I would say, and that's very, very brave, and I want to commend him for it. But all of the panelists have been extremely useful and extremely eloquent in their explanation of some of the problems and some of the suggestions for dealing with those problems, and I ask you to join me in thanking them for allowing us to sit in on this discussion.